So I'm going to start this course with a story. It's there on your outline. It's the story of the saboteurs at Norsk Hydro. I like to start the course with this story because it encapsulates so many aspects of why we find World War II fascinating. The drama of it, the high stakes. So after I tell the story, and I won't finish until, you know, a good bit through Friday's lecture, we'll sort of look back and analyze what are the features of this that help explain why World War II is so important to understand. It's the story of Norwegian secret agents who foiled Adolf Hitler's project to build a German atomic bomb. And it's typical of the stories of World War II, many stories that you can find, extremely high stakes, a few courageous men, a mind-boggling cliffhanger of a story, and the whole shape of world history hanging by the slenderest threads. It's one of my favorite stories from the war. I'm piecing together this story from several sources, my own dissertation research, which we'll talk about later in the semester, some documentary movies. But in particular, I'm drawing heavily from an excellent book that's listed at the bottom of your outline, Richard Rhodes, The Making of the Atomic Bomb. When this book came out, it won every award that could possibly be awarded, you know, Pulitzer Prize, National Book Award, National Book Critics Circle Award. It's a masterpiece of historical writing. I would assign it to you for this class and make you all read it, but it's 900 pages long, and I think you'd kill me if I did it, so I'm not going to do it. But I can't recommend it highly enough. If I had a desert island, 10 books to bring with me, this would be one of them. Fiction or nonfiction, it's one of my absolute favorite books. And I extract this story that I'm going to tell you from Richard Rhodes' magnificent account in the making of the atomic bomb. Most people today are unaware that it was not in the United States that most of the pioneering work toward harnessing atomic energy took place. We ended up building the bomb, but the pioneering work really took place in France and, believe it or not, Nazi Germany. In France, two generations of the Curie family in Paris. I suppose I should write that down. It's one of your IDs, I believe. Is it? No, it ain't. Anyway, the Curie family in Paris. Two generations of that family had come a long way toward figuring out, toward the end of the 19th century, the beginning of the 20th century, what was this mysterious, invisible force that resided in certain kinds of rocks. They gave it the name radioactivity. By the 1930s, German scientists had come far enough along to understand that radioactivity could be artificially induced in certain elements by purifying them, manipulating them chemically in their labs. In 1939, as World War II was starting, three German scientists, Otto Hahn, one of your IDs, Lise Meitner, another of your IDs, and a third scientist, Fritz Strassmann. I don't know why I didn't include him among the IDs, but maybe I just became impatient. Three German scientists, the year is 1939, they made a giant leap forward. They identified the element uranium as the key substance that could be used to create nuclear fission. Immediately, the news spread like wildfire through the elite international community of nuclear physicists. If fission was possible, and they had now found an element that could sustain it, then the release of atomic energy, the controlled release of atomic energy, might not be far away, and the more prescient among this handful of nuclear physicists saw it very clearly. The implication was it might be possible within the foreseeable future, maybe in just a few years, to create a colossal new type of bomb based on the elemental energy that holds matter together. Now, in the United States, this information led to the formation of a top-secret effort, the Manhattan Project, which was aimed at exploring the possibility of creating this kind of atomic bomb. We're going to do a whole session a whole lecture on that later in the semester, because that's one of the guys who was central to that, was the, one of the people I did my dissertation research on. But there was one question hanging over the small circle of people working feverishly on the bomb in the U.S. Statesmen like FDR, military officers, scientists, they're all asking themselves the same question. Is Hitler building one too? They didn't know. If Hitler is building a bomb, how far along is he? And so it's sort of like running a race against an adversary whom you can't see. So you don't even know if he's ahead of you or behind you, but you have to run like hell, because if you lose, you're either going to get killed or enslaved. The stakes could not be higher. Can't afford to lose this race. And it turns out that Nazi Germany was indeed working on building an atomic bomb. Hitler remained relatively skeptical about it. He had more hopes about rocket engines and jet technology. So these were his sort of leading edge, you know, wager technologies that maybe this will change, that this will be the technological breakthrough. Nuclear science, for him, in Nazi Germany, the term used to describe nuclear science was Jewish science, because it was associated with Albert Einstein. And therefore it was denigrated. They thought, well, this Jewish science, it's not going to produce anything anytime soon. It might, but not anytime soon. Hitler was not willing to dismiss the possibility, and so he assigned sort of a mid-level priority to it and assigned a sizable team with pretty good resources to explore the possibility of tapping this radioactive power, possibility of fission, for a bomb. But he didn't give it the kind of priority that it was given in the United States. Nevertheless, there was the crew of German scientists working on one particular method of refining fissionable material, uranium, to make enough of that material to start building atomic bombs. We've run out of time for today, so we'll continue the story on Friday. So I started telling you on Wednesday one of my favorite stories about World War II, which I think encapsulates some of the reasons why we all find it so fascinating as a topic to study, the story of the saboteurs at Norsk Hydro. And I had gotten as far as sort of describing just a little bit about the background of the development of nuclear science, the beginnings of nuclear science in the late 1800s, the early 1900s, emphasizing the fact that France and Germany were two key sites where the science advanced most importantly, and that in 1939, the breakthrough that ultimately made the atomic bomb possible, namely the identification of uranium as the element that could sustain fission, that happened in Germany in 1939, just as World War II was about to start. And we'll tell the story later of this one man, Leo Szilard, who figured out that what this meant and went to the United States and got the atomic bomb project started. That's something I actually wrote part of my doctoral dissertation about. We come to that later on in the course when we get to the actual atomic bomb. But this is the question sort of hovering over the top secret inner circle of physicists, but also of statesmen and military leaders. If we're aware of the uranium possibility and the possibility of building a bomb, clearly the Germans are too. After all, they're the ones who figured out it was uranium that was the key element. So the question is then, how far are the Nazis along in building an atomic bomb? So that's, I think, where we left off on Wednesday. And I also said, in fact, there was the question. Now, in retrospect, we know that the Germans did, in fact, have an atomic bomb project to which Hitler did not assign the same ultra-high priority that he did, for example, to long-range rockets or to jet aircraft. He thought those might be the war-winning technologies. He discounted the atomic bomb because it was based on nuclear science, theoretical physics. Theoretical physics in German Nazi intellectual circles was referred to as Jewish science. It was associated with all these brilliant Jewish physicists like Einstein, Szilard, and others who were making the breakthroughs. So Hitler allocated sort of a second-tier priority to the atomic bomb project, but there was definitely a German effort to make an atomic bomb. Now, the main thing you need for an atomic bomb is the right amount of fissionable material, and there are several ways to manufacture this material. People were already aware in 1939, 1940, that there might be different paths to make the material. In the United States, because we're this big country with lots of resources, we're a rich, big country, all three major methods for creating sufficiently concentrated fissionable material were tried simultaneously in secret installations spread throughout the country. One installation at the University of Chicago, one in Hanford, Washington, and one here in Tennessee at Oak Ridge. The Germans, not having the kind of funding that the Manhattan Project did, decided to put all their bets on one particular method based on something called heavy water. Heavy water was a modified form of water that could be used. I'm not going to go into the physics here, both because it takes a long time and also because I don't understand it. Heavy water is a modified form of water that can be used as a neutron moderator in this complex industrial process of enriching uranium for use as an explosive. Incidentally, it always strikes me that heavy water would be a wonderful name for a rock band. So if you ever do start a rock band, I urge you to consider it heavy water. The German team realized they need a lot of heavy water to make their project work. And so they were delighted early in the war, April 1940, when the German army was able to overrun the country of Norway very easily and rapidly, April of 1940, because tucked away in the countryside, the remote countryside of Norway, a place called Vemork, V-E-M-O-R-K, in the jagged mountainous terrain of southern Norway, tucked away there was one of Europe's largest, most modern factories of heavy water. It was called Norsk Hydro. And immediately the Nazi scientists realized what they had, started the factory working around the clock producing heavy water. So here you have a slide showing you the location within Norway. The overall region is called the Telemark. So a movie was made in the 60s starring somebody or other whose name I can't remember. Who?
Richard Harris.
The Heroes of Telemark. It's not a very good movie, but this is the actual factory, Norsk Hydro, at Vemork. Using hydroelectric power, you can see the pipes coming down the hill here. This is where the action was in making heavy water. Here's another view of Norsk Hydro. Making heavy water is a frustratingly slow process, and at the time there was no way around this. Drop by drop, in a succession of 18 large vats, the heavy water solution had to be purified. And from each vat to the next vat, it would be purified to as much as could be done in that vat, and then it would be pumped to the next vat, purified again and again, in a series of 18 pumping cycles. And each time that you did that, it had to sit in the vat for a long time to be purified, drop by drop. So Each vat leads to a more concentrated solution of this very precious liquid and then passes it on to the next vat for further concentration. This process is called a cascade. By the time you got to vat number 18, the solution was about 97% pure heavy water. The military significance was tremendous. With the capture of this factory, Norsk Hydro, the timetable for building a German atomic bomb jumped forward by about one full year, both because of the factory's capacity, also because of their existing stocks already there toward the end of these 18 vats. It had taken a long time to build up that heavy water. Now keep in mind that, you know, this is April 1940. No one knew at this time how long the war was going to last. The U.S. is not yet in the war. Manhattan Project, among those people who were in the know, very few people, the Manhattan Project itself was still a very small exploratory undertaking. If the Germans had been able to keep at their work uninterrupted, historians have gone back and estimated how long might it have taken them to actually produce an atomic bomb of their own. And some of the historians have concluded it might have been ready in as little as 6 years, 1946. Now clearly this possibility was a nightmare to the small circle of scientists and military officers and statesmen in Britain and America who were in on the secret. So it becomes, in effect, one of the most closely guarded secrets of the war. We, the Allies, are in a race with the Nazis to build something which, if it's actually possible, is without a doubt a war-winning weapon. So the Brits decided that this Norsk Hydro factory at Vemork would have to be destroyed. Absolutely top priority. You've got to take it out. They planned carefully. They established a broad network of contacts with the courageous Norwegian men and women who had joined the anti-Nazi resistance in Norway. Norway had a very vigorous resistance movement. All these people hiding among the fjords, the remote valleys of their native country, hating the German invaders. On November 19, 1942, the Brits are finally ready. They send in two highly trained demolition teams. They fly them in gliders across the North Sea from Scotland. Unfortunately, both planes crashed. The weather was not with them. Both planes crashed. The survivors, some of the people were killed in the crash. Some of the other commandos, all the other commandos were immediately captured by the Germans and executed the same day. So, 0-1. The Brits knew they could not afford to stop trying. So in February of 1943, 5 months later, on a freezing cold night, this time six Norwegian commandos were parachuted into the snow, the countryside near Vemork. And here I'm going to read to you from the book that I was recommending to you. It's listed at the bottom of your outline, from which I'm drawing much of this story. The Pulitzer Prize winning book by Richard Rhodes, The Making of the Atomic Bomb. So this is the Norwegian commando team of February 1943. The men wore white jumpsuits over British Army uniforms and parachuted with skis, supplies, a shortwave radio, and 18 sets of plastic explosives, one for each of the 18 stainless steel electrolysis cells of the high concentration plant. They set out mid-evening on Saturday, February 27, 1943, leaving one man behind to guard the radios. They carried cyanide capsules and agreed if anyone was wounded, he would take his own life rather than allow himself to be captured and risk betraying his comrades. These guys mean business. They crashed down through soft snow all the way to the bottom of the gorge, crossed the frozen river, climbed up toward the plant on the other side. Above, at the elevation of the shelf, was a seldom-used railroad siding leading into the compound that they hoped the Germans had chosen not to mine. Quote, "It was a dark night, and there was no moon. remembers Knut Haukelid, one of the commando leaders. I'll show you a picture of him. Oops. This is Knut Haukelid, one of the... Oh, and right here is that team of the February 43 group, still in training in England before being parachuted in. This is one of the leaders of the assault team, Knut Haukelid. Actually, if anyone speaks Norwegian, bear with me. I have no idea how to pronounce that name. I'm just doing my best here. It was a dark night. There was no moon. The searchlights were kept turned off, and the high wind drowned all the noise we made. Half an hour before midnight, we came to a snow-covered building 500 yards from Vemork, where we ate a little chocolate and waited for the change of sentries. We divided into two groups, a demolition party and a covering party. We were well-armed, 5 Tommy guns among 9 men, and everyone had a pistol, a knife, and hand grenades. In an hour, time for the sentries to settle, they attacked. Haukelid and the covering party led the way. With bolt cutters, they snipped the thin little iron chain which barred the way to one of the most important military objectives in Europe. The covering party dispersed to its prearranged positions. Haukelid and one other man took up posts 20 yards from the Wehrmacht barracks. Wehrmacht is the German word, means armed force. It's the German army. Took up posts 20 yards from the Wehrmacht barracks, a flimsy wooden building that they saw they could easily shoot through, and the demolition party moved ahead. The doors on the ground floor of the plant were locked, but the Norwegian resistance had identified for the commandos a cable intake that they could crawl along that led directly to the heavy water facility. 2 men looked for some other entrance, in case that one didn't work out, while 2 disappeared into the cable intake. After what seemed to Haukelid like an interminable delay, he heard an explosion, quote, but an astonishingly small, insignificant one. Was this what we had come over 1,000 miles to do? The guards were slow to check. Only 1 German soldier appeared and seemed not to realize what had happened. He tried the doors to the plant, found them locked, looked to see if snow falling from the mountain above had detonated a landmine, and returned to his quarters. The Norwegians moved out fast. They had descended to the river before the sirens began to sound. The operation was successful. Picture the Germans took of their wrecked plant. No one was injured on either side. All 18 cells had been blown open, spilling nearly 0.5 ton of heavy water into the drains. Not only would the plant require weeks to repair, but because it was a cascade pumping water of increasing heavy water concentration from one cell to the next, it would need almost a year of operation after repair, simply to reach equilibrium again on its own and begin producing the 97% pure solution. General Nikolaus von Falkenhorst, the commander-in-chief of the occupying German army in Norway, called the Vemork attack, quote, the best coup I have ever seen. Nevertheless, by the fall of 1943, so 6 months after this successful raid, Norwegian intelligence operatives there on site in Norway began reporting back to London. It looked like the Germans had succeeded in getting Norsk Hydro back into operation much more quickly than they had anticipated. How? Scientists went around Germany to all the universities and commercial laboratories and requisitioned all the stocks of heavy water, small or large, that they could find, put them together, brought them back up to Norway in secret to seed the plant and get the 18 electrolysis cells functioning again, sort of jump-starting the process. So they've now taken all the heavy water out of Germany and put it there at Norsk Hydro. The Brits decided, obviously, once again, something has to be done very urgently. The idea of a second commando raid was quashed right away because the Germans, after this successful attack, and massively beefed up security all around Vemork and the nearby town of Ryukan and the factory itself. So the only alternative appeared to be aerial bombing. Therefore, on November 16, 1943, several hundred B-17 bombers from the American 8th Air Force were dispatched to Norway from British bases. Out of those several hundred, 140 bombers made it through the German air defenses in Norway and bombed Vemork heavily, destroying the factory's power station and damaging the main electrolysis unit where the heavy water was being produced. So at this point, the Germans say, that's enough. They decide the best thing to do is to dismantle the factory, ship it along with all the heavy water in the vats back down to Germany. The plan was to reassemble the factory in a mine shaft under a German mountain so it would be safe from bombers or saboteurs. But the main thing was the heavy water itself was far more precious than the machinery of the factory. A new factory could be fairly rapidly put together, but the water was irreplaceable. It embodied 2 years of laboriously accumulated stocks, and obviously, if you're going to try to make an atomic weapon in time to make a difference in this war, time is of the essence. One of the things that the Germans did not know, sitting in occupied Paris, by this time they'd obviously occupied Paris, sitting in occupied Paris was an entire railroad car, tank car, full of heavy water, pure heavy water. And one of the top nuclear physicists, Frédéric Joliot-Curie, who had married one of the daughters of the Curie family, Irène Curie, knew about the existence of that railroad car. It was there for research purposes for the nuclear physicists in France. They kept it quiet, realizing what the danger was, and they decided, if we try to destroy it, if we try to get in there, and we might get caught, then we'll alert them to the presence. The best thing to do is just to do nothing, let it sit. And so that tank car sat there through the entire war, rusting in a side yard of one of the railroad yards in Paris through the entire war, unbeknownst to the Germans. February of 1944, spies in the Norwegian underground alert London by radio. The Nazis are going to be shipping their precious heavy water stock back down to Germany in just under 2 weeks. So the Brits and the Americans start casting desperately for a solution. We simply don't have enough time to train and send in a new group of commandos. Only one man from the previous commando attack of 1943 was still in place near the town of Ryukan in hiding, watching over the Norsk Hydro factory. It was our friend Knut Haukelid. He'd been living there in hiding, dodging the Germans continually for just over a year since the previous raid. British and American officers in London come to a grim conclusion. It's all on this guy. Somehow he's going to have to do the job by himself. He's going to have to destroy the heavy water at some point as it's being shipped from the factory down to the Norwegian coast. So they radioed him his orders. Haukelid quickly began recruiting helpers from the Norwegian underground near the town of Ryukan. He studied the path that the train carrying the heavy water shipment with its tank cars, studied the path that the train would be taking. And it looked ultimately concluded that the weakest link in the journey would be the moment when the train cars were loaded onto a ferry boat and carried across the local lake, a long, deep body of water named Lake Tinsjö. He rowed the ferry boat back and forth several times, carefully timing its trips so that he would know exactly when it would be crossing the deepest part of the lake. This is Norway, so the lakes are deep, 1,300 feet deep in this case. The ferry boat's name, ironically, was the Hydro. just like the factory whose top secret products it would be carrying. Haukel had prepared a large supply of plastic explosive and calculated how large a hole he would have to blow in the ferry's hull if it was to sink before it could be beached or steered to shallower waters where the tank cars could be retrieved. He borrowed two alarm clocks and modified them so that when they clicked and the alarm rang, the hammers didn't strike the bell to make the sound ding, 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 but instead would be striking contact plates, closing a battery-powered electrical circuit and triggering the detonators. So this is going to be a bomb in which you're using an old-fashioned home alarm clock as your timing device. He reported his plan back to London. Here was the reply sent to him by telegraph, secret telegraph. Agree to sinking of ferry with IMI cargo in deep water, preferably between Hesleviken and Digerud. Stop. If the sea cocks are opened, this must be combined with an explosion to indicate a limpet attack from outside. The engine must be put out of order so that the ferry cannot be driven further to shallow water. 29 of the 10th. The sinking must not fail, as the method of attack will thereby be disclosed. Leave British uniform effects, if possible, at suitable place. In other words, make it look like it was a British commando who was attacking, not Norwegians, because otherwise the Germans would go to nearby villages and massacre everybody. That's what that line means, leave British uniform. And then finally, good luck. On the night of February 20th, 1944, well past midnight, Haukelid and two trusted helpers from the underground drove down to the wharf where the ferry was docked. The train cars carrying the heavy water had not yet been loaded onto the boat. Haukelid could see them parked on a railroad siding several hundred meters away, lit up with floodlights and surrounded by patrolling sentries. This is Haukelid speaking now. Armed with Sten guns, pistols, and hand grenades, we crept down toward the ferry. The bitterly cold night set everything creaking and crackling. The ice on the road snapped sharply as we went over it. When we came out on the bridge by the ferry station, there was as much noise as if a whole company was on the march. Rolf and the other Ryukan man were told to cover me while I went on board the ferry to reconnoiter. All was quiet there. Was it possible that the Germans had omitted to place a guard at the weakest point in the whole route to the transport? Hearing voices in the crew's quarters forward, I stole to the companionway and listened. There must be a party going on down there and a game of poker. The other two followed me onto the deck of the ferry. We went down to the third-class accommodation and found a hatchway leading to the bilges. But before we had got the hatch open, we heard steps and took cover behind the nearest table or chair. The ferry watchman was standing in the doorway. I thought fast, realizing that the situation was awkward, but not necessarily dangerous. I told the watchman we were escaping the Gestapo and needed a place to hide. The watchman immediately showed us the hatchway in the deck and told us that they had several times carried illegal things with them on their trips. So the watchman is sympathetic to the resistance. The Ryukan man now proved invaluable. He talked and talked with the watchman while Rolf and I flung our sacks down under the deck and began to work. It was an anxious job, and it took time. Haukelid and Rolf Sorli found themselves standing on the bottom plates of the boat in a foot of cold water. They had to tape the two alarm clock timers to one of the steel stringers that braced the ferry's hull, attach four electric detonators to the timers, attach high-speed fuses to the loop of plastic explosive, lay the charge of explosive on the bottom plates, and then, most dangerously, hook up batteries to detonators and detonators to fuses. Haukelid. The charge was placed in the water and concealed. It consisted of 19 pounds of high explosive laid in the form of a sausage. We laid it in the forward part of the bilge, so the rudder and propeller would rise above the surface when water began to come in, and this way prevent navigating the boat to shallower water. Right? So they do blow a hole in the front of the boat, water comes in the front of the boat, that goes down, and the propeller gets lifted out of the water, they can't go anywhere. When the charge exploded, it would blow about 11 square feet out of the ship's side. Rolf Sorley went up on deck. Haukelid set his alarms to go off at 10:45 a.m. Quote, making the last connection was a dangerous job, for an alarm clock is an uncertain instrument, and contact between the hammer and the alarm was avoided by not more than a third of an inch. Thus, there was one third of an inch between us and disaster. But everything worked, and he finished at 4 a.m. The Ryukan man had convinced the watchman by then that the escapees he had sheltered needed to return to Ryukan to collect their possessions. Haukelid considered warning their benefactor, but decided that might endanger the mission. So he only thanked him and shook his hand. 10 minutes from the ferry station, Haukelid and Larsen put on skis and began the long trek to Kongsberg, 40 miles away around the lake, where they would catch a train for the first leg of their escape to Sweden. Sorley carried a report for London to the clandestine radio. 6 hours later, with 53 people aboard, as well as the railroad cars holding the heavy water, the ferry sailed on time. 45 minutes into the crossing, Haukelid's charge of plastic explosive blew the hull. The captain felt the explosion rather than heard it, and though Teenzio is landlocked, he thought they might have been torpedoed. The bow swamped first, as Haukelid had intended. While the passengers and crew struggled to release the lifeboats, the freight cars, with their 39 drums of heavy water, broke loose, rolled overboard, and sank like stones. Of passengers and crew, 26 drowned. Later, in an interview after the war, Kurt Diebner of German Army Ordnance described the full effect of the sinking of the Hydro. Quote, when one considers that right up to the end of the war in 1945, there was virtually no increase in our heavy water stocks in Germany, it will be seen that it was the elimination of German heavy water production in Norway that was the main factor in our failure to achieve a self-sustaining atomic reactor before the war ended. And so Richard Rhodes concludes his account. The race to the bomb, such as it was, ended for Germany on a mountain lake in Norway on a cold Sunday morning in February 1944. So why have I told you this story? I chose it because it captures some of the main elements of why World War II still fascinates us today. A deadly peril. Is Adolf Hitler going to get nukes or not? Brave men taking amazing risks. A game with extremely far-reaching consequences, resting on the tiniest of details, like the personality of a night watchman, or that one-third of an inch between the alarm clock hammer and the contact plate. One man, Knut Haukelid, making a deep mark on the course of world history. And then fading away after the war into the obscurity of civilian life. How many of you had heard of the name Knut Haukelid before today? Isn't that interesting? We should have statues to the guy in every city. But we don't. I learned about it from Rhodes' book. One of my favorite parts of this story actually comes on the night when they're going down to the ferry, just as they're getting ready to go down and plant the explosive. Knut Haukelid has to steal a car to get from his hiding place to the wharf where the ferry is anchored. He has no way to travel that distance from where he's safe in hiding to the wharf. So he has chosen which car he's going to steal. As with many cars during World War II, when gasoline was hard to come by, this car had been converted by its owner to run on methane instead of gasoline. And methane, it's harder to get the cars to start. That's the problem. Haukelid and his two companions get in the car, hotwire it, but then they have a hell of a time getting the damn thing started. German soldiers walking by, and they're pretending to be the owner of the car, having a hard time getting the car to start. German soldiers snickering at them. It went on for just under an hour, trying to get the car to start. So I like to imagine him and his two companions, you know, Haukelid turning the key or holding the wires together. And you hear the sound of the starter. It's cold outside. The battery's running down. We're running out of time. If we don't get to the ferry soon, it'll be too late to get there and plant the explosives in time. And from the back seat, you know, your companions are telling you how to back seat, you know, start the car. You're flooding it. And you're thinking, if I can't get this car to start, Hitler is going to get the atomic bomb. German soldiers still passing by, laughing at these clueless, non-mechanical Norwegians who can't even get a car to start. You're smiling at them. Yeah, we sure are dumb. And then finally, vroom, it starts, and off they go into history. So in a way, it was all hinging on that, too, getting the car to start. We talk about high stakes. In World War II, you know, people talk world domination. Well, that's exactly what was, in fact, at stake in World War II. And here it's useful to compare what was at stake in World War I compared to World War II. In World War I, whoever wins, whoever loses, what's at stake is basically the acquisition of more territory, new imperial holdings. Germany loses. But there's never any serious question of whether Germany itself will continue to exist after the surrender. Nobody seriously suggests that all the people of Germany, men, women, and children, should be killed. Maybe a few people had the thought during World War I, but nobody in a position of power seriously considered a policy like that. In World War II, what's at stake is a fundamental reshaping of world power. Some people will gain, some people will lose, and some people are simply going to disappear from the face of the earth. And so in some ways, it's really about extermination, survival at the most elemental level. Can you imagine what the world would be like today if the Germans had won? Now, obviously, in a sense, it's too complicated, a counterfactual. It's impossible to answer. But it's thought-provoking nonetheless, and some novelists have actually tried to imagine how different things would be. Supposing you were alive in this alternative world where the Germans won World War II, how different would your life be? You know, would we all be sitting here telling this story very differently, going Sieg Heil? Another factor in understanding the stakes of World War II is the scale of this war. It's quite simply the biggest single event in recorded history. It was played out to varying degrees on all the world's continents, except Antarctica, all the world's oceans, even the Arctic Ocean. The numbers of dead in World War II, the estimates keep creeping up every year. I have to keep adjusting. It used to be thought 30 to 40 million people were killed, military and civilians. Now the estimates range between 55 and 70 million human beings lost their life in this war. You could not be alive anywhere on the planet at the time of this war and not be directly or indirectly affected by it. So, you know, Eskimos up north, tribesmen in New Guinea, beef farmers on the Argentinian Pampa, bushmen of the Kalahari, you name it. Everyone in these most remote areas and everyone in between, basically every human being who was alive and breathing was affected by this conflagration, which is why for the oral history report, I basically say, you can interview anyone you want. This war will, if they live through it, it had an impact on their lives. And if they're old enough to remember, they'll be able to tell you what that impact was. Even without Hitler's victory, the war brought about a real revolution in world power. Old nations faded from the scene, new nations rose up and took their place. If you look at your outline, I've just drawn a little schematic there of how I think of the shape of power in the 20th century. It's like an hourglass. Starts out wide, gets narrow, and then widens out again with the passing of time. By that I mean, in the period, the first half of the century, 1900 to 1945, the world order is a multipolar order. There are six great powers competing with each other and three ideologies vying for dominance, for control of the hearts and minds of the masses of the world. World War II drastically narrows that down. Two great powers and only two ideologies. Communism and liberal capitalism. And then gradually, as the decades have gone by since the war, it started diversifying back out again and moving once again toward a multipolar world with multiple ideologies as well. So, in a sense, it's like putting a magnet down. You know, imagine a table with iron filings on it, and you put a magnet down on it, and all the iron filings go and arrange themselves according to the force field of the magnet. In a sense, the event of World War II is like that magnet sitting in the middle of 20th century history, and it totally changes everything. So even without the Nazi victory, the Japanese victory, even with the outcome that it went this way, it still completely altered world history very profoundly. This is what I mean when I say high stakes. In the space of 6 years, world politics completely reshaped. The rise and fall of entire civilizations, entire societies, entire ways of life. There's another aspect of this war that I think also etches it into the consciousness of our society so much. And I sum this up with the two words, Auschwitz and Hiroshima. And we'll be talking a lot about both of these later in the course. I want to just say briefly why these two terms encapsulate for me this other dimension of meaning in the war. At the beginning of when I teach my course on 20th century Europe, we talk about Henry Ford and the automobile assembly lines. Henry Ford's great innovation, Taylorism, everything set up for efficiency, for mass production. Every worker has a specific task, which he repeats endlessly. How many of you have seen Charlie Chaplin's film, Modern Times? If you haven't seen it, you should. It's a wonderful parody of the whole thing. The whole system has been carefully analyzed in advance for ergonomic efficiency, designed rationally so as to waste as little time and energy as possible in the process of bringing all the various parts and processes together to make the final product, a car. It's a big flow of practices. Starting in 1942, in Germany and Central Europe, the same kind of logic was applied to the killing of human beings. It was turned into an industry. Auschwitz was a factory in which rationality and efficiency governed daily life, in which workers clocked in and clocked out with routine regularity doing their specialized jobs, in which managers struggled to meet demanding production schedules, in which R&D teams, research and development teams, worked feverishly to develop ever more efficient techniques. And the raw material coming into the factory was human beings, and the product was ashes. And so in this sense, World War II brought us face to face with the deepest kind of evil that humankind can imagine. Evil in the sense that this was deliberate. This was not like what just happened in Haiti, an awful thing, a catastrophe, but wasn't anybody's fault. This was deliberate. It showed a capacity for malice and for premeditated taking your hate and turning it into policy at a level that I think most people had not thought possible. In fact, I think it's something beyond our imagining what happened in the Holocaust, something that strains to the breaking point our capacity to comprehend, to grasp, to encompass it with our minds. The German philosopher Theodor Adorno, an anti-fascist, writing after World War II, he summed up this aspect of it with a question. He said, "How will it be possible to write poetry after Auschwitz? How can anyone write a poem when we know that this is what humanity is capable of?" And then there's the other side of the coin, Hiroshima. Because with Hiroshima, you take the final step. Auschwitz showed that we humans had the capacity for malice, for hatred, for cruelty on an unimaginable level. Hiroshima showed we now possess the tools with which to make that hatred bear fruit if we wanted to. Spectacular fruit. Entire cities wasted. Just like that. Entire peoples, if you wanted to. The whole planet. Why not? This is no longer science fiction. This was plain and simple reality. So I guess what I'm saying is World War II showed that we humans possessed both the will, in some cases, and the means, now, through technology, to destroy anything, anywhere, anytime, no matter how small or large, all the way up to the planetary scale. So if you were a child growing up in the post-war world, you gradually had to sort of assimilate this interesting fact. Somewhere over the rainbow, there's a killing machine with your very own name on it, your very own address inscribed somewhere there in the circuitry. You can never escape. They're targetable everywhere, and during the Cold War, they were targeted certainly everywhere. So the crosshairs are everywhere, too. And I think this is very much part of the legacy of World War II, the possibility of planetary suicide, all the ways in which living with that possibility has changed our lives. Auschwitz, a deeper capacity for hate than we ever thought possible, and Hiroshima, the technology now to make that hate, for anybody to take their hate and make it bear that kind of awful fruit. We got a couple minutes for questions or comments. If anybody wants to raise a question or make a comment. Yeah?
Do we know if the Japanese ever had any sort of nuclear technology?
Question is, do we know if the Japanese ever had nuclear technology? The answer is we do know, and they did not. They never. They were exploring biological weapons, and we'll be talking about that later in the course. They didn't go with the nuclear technology, but they did some pretty awful things in experimenting with biological weapons, trying to build biological weapons. Well, Hitler was building a special bomber. We know that he had a plan for a certain long-range bomber and for long-range three-stage rockets. capable of reaching across the Atlantic. I don't think he would have hesitated to do to the eastern seaboard of the United States with nuclear weapons, if possible, what he did to the Brits in London and other British cities. We know, I mean, they called it the America, with a K, America bomber. That wasn't yet built when the war ended, but it was all in advanced planning stage. And the rockets were being built. The intercontinental ballistic missiles were under development with Wernher von Braun and his crew in Germany. I think that he would have been happy to put together the rocket technology and the nuclear technology if he could have. I think there's no question that he would have used it. Okay, I think we've run out of time.